Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another Science Studio program. My name is Keith Pell. I'm here with Russ Chianelli, as usual. And today we're down in Marfa, Texas, which is just a nice little town outside of the Big Bend National Park. And today we're going to be talking about the importance of the Big Bend National Park. And Russ, who is going to be our guest?
We're very happy to welcome to Science Studio Melissa Williams. She's from the Center for Big Bend Studies. She's an archaeologist. And welcome to Science Studio.
Hello. Nice to have you here in town.
Well, absolutely. It's nice to be here. We've had a very enjoyable time. Stayed at the old El Paisano Hotel, and I can recommend that to anybody. Get to meet interesting people.
Did you stay in the James Dean room or the Elizabeth Taylor room?
Well, I'm not telling you which room we stayed in. Inappropriate question. Anyway, Melissa, tell us. You're an archaeologist.
I'm an archaeologist and a historian.
And a historian.
I go both ways, yes.
Well, this is wonderful. Tell us, how did you get into this as a career? Before we get on to your particular passion with the Big Bend, how did you get into this as a career?
Well, I did my seventh grade science project on the Hohokam of central Arizona. I grew up in Phoenix, and my dad was a road engineer. So family trips were driving around Arizona looking at the pavement to see if the asphalt was up to snuff. My father, he would take a pen and put it down on the ground and take a picture of the road. He called himself a crack photographer. That was what we did in the summer, was hang around with him. So while he was talking to the road folks, I would go wandering, and I found my first pieces of pottery, and not so much arrowheads in Arizona. It was mostly pottery. But I collected them all and pasted them down to a piece of cardboard for my seventh grade science project.
I mean, that's a pretty tough operation in the summer in the Phoenix area. I
mean, oh,
doing
yes.
It in the winter might be enjoyable, but in the summer, that's
not summer's tough. Summer's tough. You don't do anything from about noon to four.
So you were trained to be an observer, really.
That's true.
Yeah.
That's true.
Mm-hmm. And then how did you progress then from going around in hot summer days looking for cracks and getting into a career?
Well, I went to, had to leave Arizona to go away to school, you know, had to get away from home. And so I came to Texas and went to Rice University, which had an archaeology department of two, Dr. Rich Blanton and Dr. Frank Hole. And Dr. Frank Hole said, well, if you're going to be an archaeologist, you are a woman, and so that's kind of tough. You need to specialize. So I ended up getting my master's at the University of Texas in physical anthropology, dealing with bones. I had intended to be the bone person that went along with the digs because, gosh, a woman really couldn't run a dig on her own. So that was 1970. Then I interviewed at the Texas Department of Transportation about 1972 for a job after I'd finished my master's. And the fellow said, well, you're married. I said, yeah. He said, well, we don't send married women out on field projects.
Just single women?
I said, right. What, you only want single women? What? What's wrong with that? And so I did not get hired at TxDOT in 1972 because I was a woman.
Did you pursue that? I mean, have you gone back and asked them, do they still have this policy of only single women going on?
Well, obviously they don't. Obviously things have changed. But
or you could get a quickie divorce and then get remarried after the dig.
That's right. That's right. Sorry, hub, I'm leaving. So I took a detour. I went into publishing and advertising for about 20 years.
Oh, so you've taken a big
I did all
movement.
Kinds of things.
Right.
Yeah, I did all kinds of things. I worked at Texas Monthly for a while in the 70s, and then we moved back to Arizona, and I worked at Phoenix Magazine and a couple of ad agencies, and then decided I'd had enough of the modern world and went back to school and got a master's in history. And then from there went into cultural resource management, doing historical archaeology and archaeology.
But it's really a labor of love, isn't it? I mean, you don't get rich being an archaeologist.
That's right.
My son, Julian, studied archaeology for a while, and he said, Dad, I don't think I can make any money doing this. And now he's an engineer.
You can make money, but you can't get rich.
So tell us, the Center for Big Bend Studies, what it's at Sol Ross State University.
The Center for Big Bend Studies is a department at Sol Ross State University. It was founded there about 20 years ago by a historian. And it was always with the idea of doing both the history and archaeology of the Big Bend area. So for a long time, it was about a person and a half. And what they basically did was publish the Journal for Big Bend Studies every year. And then Bob Maloof came out here in the mid-1990s, and said, let's step this up a bit. So he started doing more archaeology and then casting about for more funding. And 5 years ago, we got a huge grant, and we've been doing tremendous amounts of archaeology under what we call the Trans-Pecos Archaeological Program over the last 5 years.
And that funding was from the national parks or from the
Texas? No, that was from, we get some funding through the Colorado State University, we get some from private individuals, and we get some from foundations. And this big chunk was from the Brown Foundation.
The Brown Foundation.
Mm-hmm.
And that's centered where?
That's in Houston.
And they just do specifically things like archaeology and history, or?
They do all kinds of things. In fact, they finance a lot at Rice University. There's a building, several of the buildings on campus have the word Brown in them somewhere.
Russ and I are both taking note of this, the Brown Foundation.
Brown Foundation is very generous.
Could you tell us a little bit about, you make a distinction between history and archaeology, which is not something that's obvious to people that watch or listen to this show. Could you discuss that a little bit?
Well, first of all, neither history nor archaeology deals with dinosaurs. That's the first distinction you have to make, because when
you're
a
paleontologist.
When you tell people, oh, I'm an archaeologist, they say, oh, that's so cool, I just love dinosaurs. You go, no. Both history and archaeology deal with human beings,
right?
The history of humans. History tends to deal with recorded history. Archaeology tends to deal with cultures that didn't have writing. That's not totally true, but in general, that's true.
Because we would sort of think, without being in the field, that, you know, well, the archaeology would give evidence to develop a history. Or would you say that's not accurate?
Oh, I see what you're saying. If you're going to write the history of a people, you could do some of it through...
Yeah, we'd say, well, they're buried here, and when the carbon dating shows it was this, so the history is that these people came in this period or something.
That's true. That'd be a broader use of the word history. In the scholarly world, when you're talking history, when you're talking about a historian, you're talking about someone who goes basically through documents and photos and archives and puts together the history of a people through paper, where an archaeologist would put together the history of a people through building remnants, pottery, flint, arrow points, whatever. But you're right, they both reconstruct the histories of a culture.
Well, how about here? Here we are in Marfa, and this, what to us is a very isolated place. Can you give us a little background? What is the archaeology and history that exists that we know of here?
In the Big Bend, we focus on the what we call the Big Bend area, which would be south of here, and the Eastern Trans-Pecos, which would be north of here. And in both of those areas, we've had hunter-gatherer nomadic peoples for what I like to say 800 generations.
Okay, so 800 generations would be something like what? How many
years? It would go back to the Paleo-Indian period, about 6,000 BC. We have evidence all the way from Paleo-Indians, of course, through Archaic, through late prehistory, Spanish, all the way to present day. There's been people here at all times in the last several thousand years.
Okay, so as the Europeans arrived, who was here then?
Who was here then?
To greet them.
Basically two divisions. This is a rough description of who is here. There were a group of people that were living in along the river in Presidio, and they were farming using the water there. They were more settled people. And then there was a group.
Growing what? Corn, maize?
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Corn, beans, and squash. CBS, the central diet of Middle America.
You say that with such ease, like, you know, everybody CBS. Knows this. Corn, beans, and squash.
Corn, beans, and squash. CBS. And then there was a group of people that were more nomadic, that interacted with the people. We call the people on the river the La Junta people, because that's where the Rio Conchos and the Rio Grande join, the joining. So those are generally referred to as La Junta people. And then there's the nomadic peoples, which have various sundry names depending on which archaeologist you're reading at the time.
So the people that were not nomadic,
mm-hmm.
What was the sort of the structure of their dwellings and their organized villages or whatever you would call them?
They were one-story adobe buildings.
Are there remnants of these?
You bet there are.
There are lots of them.
There's five or not that people can visit. It's not like a national park site where you can park in the shade and talk to a ranger about it. But archaeologically, we know there's about five or six villages up and down the Rio Grande there near Presidio.
And if you go there now on an academic investigation or visit, what would you see?
You'd just see
the foundation?
Not much. I mean, you'd see kind of undulations in the ground. You'd have to do the digging to really see more. It's not like in Arizona, New Mexico, where you can actually see the buildings.
So you've had to reconstruct this in your imagination from what?
From the footprint of the buildings.
Right.
From the post holes that you see in the ground, and you can see where the dirt changes. You can see where they would have patted down the dirt inside the houses and put their post holes and created the adobe
from
there.
And also burials, no?
Not a lot. For all the 800 generations that have lived here, we have very few burials that we've dealt with.
Because I know this, but about the same period. Well, you're talking about 6,000 years or 2,000 years or something like that.
We're talking more like the Paleo-Indian period is 9,500 to 6,500 BC. So if you make it BP, that makes it about 10,000 years, más o menos.
We have some in El Paso where they're burials, but they're younger than that.
That's up at the Keystone Heritage Park?
Yeah, Keystone Heritage Park. Yeah, right. There's clear burial places that you can see.
So when you say they're single story, how do you know that? This really puts science in the right light.
That's right.
You know, we just surmise, but I mean,
we also have, there is historical evidence when the Spanish came north through the La Junta area. There are several descriptions written by Spaniards of what they saw.
So that would
in the same region that you're speaking of.
Exactly the same region. Mm-hmm.
You know, one of the questions that intrigues me is that, and the reason I ask about burials, you find bones, right?
Human bones. As I say, not many.
Okay, but if you do find one, there's a possibility that DNA is still intact for analysis. And I know that there was some analysis in the state of Washington of some of the DNA of people from that period. And they were saying that this was a European that
exactly.
was over there, you know?
Right. You remember that famous case when on the river? I don't remember the river, but they found this, the remains of a person.
Mm-hmm. A 50-year-old European with a bad hip from a knife wound, as I remember.
But the problem was...
his name was Charlie.
Right. Well, but the more important feature was the fact this was on Native American
exactly.
land. And they were very reticent to let investigations be performed on these remains.
Well, they even stopped some thesis. So the students did get their thesis, but everything
You're speaking of Kennewick, man.
Yes, that's right. But the argument there that some people gave to me was the fact that the bigger issue was that if it was proven to be a European, now this wouldn't be Native American land, and so the casino rights would be up for grabs. Right?
Politics. But I would like to say that the DNA is really one of the exciting new things that's coming along in archaeology. What we've got out here, and we haven't done it yet, but we're talking about doing it. They've done some in Arizona, where they've taken what they call quids, which are the plant remains that the Native Americans would chew, sort of like we chew chewing gum, but they would be getting nutrients out of it. And you can find, in archaeological digs, you can find these quids, or these little clumps of matted vegetable matter. And there's some thought that we can take those quids and extract some of the DNA that would have been in the saliva of the people that
True.
Chewed it.
So they were sort of like chewing their cud with these leaves and
leaving
these little, I don't know what you would call them, quids.
Quids. Yeah, so there's some work to try to extract DNA from quids. We have a couple of, this sounds really odd, but it's wonderful, from excavations every once in a while you'll find a hair. We maybe have 3 hairs now in the lab at Center for Big Bend Studies that we're itching to see if we can't do something with it,
well,
DNA-wise.
How do you tell it's an ancient hair rather than one you just dropped?
Well, you know, when you're digging, and you're digging very carefully with the paintbrush, and here's a hair coming out of the wall of the side of your unit, you have white hair like I do, and it's long black hair. It's not yours.
I mean, it's remarkable to me, I mean, that you can find these quids, and you can find the odd hair. You've got 3 of them, and yet you don't find many remains of the people. What do you assume?
It's one of the big questions. One assumption is that, of course, the earlier the site, the more buried it is. And we know from, there's a particular site I'm thinking of that was revealed in the cut of an arroyo. That's an early archaic site. And that's like 20 feet below the surface. So some of these early sites are so buried that we haven't seen them yet.
What about aerial photography or satellite photography, where you can see formations of areas that you cannot see from the ground, you know, where there could be underneath 20 feet, but some structural arrangement for a cemetery, for example?
I mean, how do you know that there's not a burial ground out there that you haven't found yet?
Well, of course, we don't. We don't know that we haven't found it yet. I'm trying to think. We do use aerial photography. We've been using it as a mapping technique, because with computer-aided aerial photography, you can do a map of a site much, much faster than doing it
right.
on your own. I've seen aerial photography, again, done in the Southwest where you have more architecture. We don't have that much architecture that we're dealing with.
No, but you might see certain patterns that, you know, I mean, if you can get money to do an aerial survey, you may be seeing structural arrangements that you don't even recognize.
It's a possibility. Yeah. It's a possibility. I'm thinking the other aerial photography I'm thinking of is where you see patterns in like the cornfields. You know, like in Mexico, if there's a site in a cornfield, it affects the way the corn grows.
Right.
And everything here is so arid and bare dirt. I'm not sure you could, but maybe you could.
It's worth a proposal.
It's worth a proposal. We'll go after the National Science Foundation with that one.
You're listening to Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell. I'm here with Russ Chianelli. And today we're talking to Melissa Williams from the Center for Big Bend Studies in Marfa, Texas. The actual Big Bend Studies are in the Sul Ross State University in Alpine, Texas. We'll be back in one moment.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog.
And I'm Dr. David Niesel. For a lot of us, the big question about Mars has been whether water really does or did exist. And if so, it may indicate the presence of life.
But you know, Dave, we may be closer than ever to an answer thanks to NASA's Phoenix Mars lander. It arrived in May and has performed the first chemical analysis of the Martian soil.
It found that the soil chemistry is close to the upper dry valleys of Antarctica. The composition is somewhat alkaline and contains chemical salts we associate with life on Earth. Plus, photographs of the landing site revealed white chunks of matter that, when exposed, disappeared over a few days.
NASA scientists say that's proof the matter is ice. To investigate further, the lander will bake soil samples to see if gaseous water is released. It'll also look for other chemicals associated with life so we know whether living organisms existed on Mars.
Or that life still exists beneath the Martian surface, which would be astounding. Finding extraterrestrial life would shed light on how life evolved on Earth.
You know, Dave, we already have findings that may point to life outside Earth. Meteorites discovered in the Antarctic contain amino acids, the building blocks of proteins. Another key molecule associated with life, ribonucleic acids, were found in another meteor that fell in Australia.
So could the theory of panspermia be true? It originated from the early 1900s, suggesting life on Earth came from an extraterrestrial source such as a meteor. Then, in 1973, Francis Crick, the co-discoverer of DNA, suggested life here came from directed panspermia, meaning it was left behind by space visitors who seeded early Earth's primordial conditions with simple organisms.
As we continue space exploration, we may just get closer to an answer.
We are Drs. David Niesel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch in Galveston, where biomedical discoveries are shaping the future of medicine. For much more on this, go to www.medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Welcome back to Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell, Russ Chianelli, and today we're with Melissa Williams from the Center for Big Bend Studies, Sul Ross State University in Alpine, Texas. So, Melissa, tell us a little bit more about some of the pressures that you find to study the Big Bend region. What are some of the reasons that it's actually imperative to have such a center?
Well, the big reason is, of course, looting. When you come out here from the big city, you look around and you say, oh, there's nobody out here. It's very open and wonderful, and I'm sure it's pristine. But everybody loves airheads, and there have been looters out here for 100 years. One of our major research focuses has been on rock shelters, because that's been a target for looters.
By rock shelter, you mean a cave?
No, a rock shelter is where it's sort of halfway between a cave and a cliff. It's where the rock comes out far enough off the cliff that you can get shade under it during parts of the day. Maybe not all the day, but parts of the day.
Okay.
So it's not really a cave. It doesn't go back that far. There are a lot of rock shelters out here because of the terrain, of course, because of the geology. And we have yet to find a rock shelter that has not been looted.
And when you say looted, does that necessarily mean 20th, 21st century, or... You know, can the remains from 6,000 years ago have been looted 4,000 years ago?
20th century.
Okay.
20th century, 21st century.
Because you see
yes.
the beer cans and all the rest of it that go along with
it. You see the
it.
Shovels, you see the screens. Oh. Yes.
You mean they leave that behind?
Yes.
Systematically doing this?
Yes, yes.
Not just, oh, there's one there.
No. I would say there's three levels of looters. There's the kind that walks along the desert and picks up a few arrowheads. And then there's the fellow that... I say fellow, could be girl, that takes buckets and shovels and screens and ladders and climbs up into the rock shelters and digs their way through.
Yeah, but in defense of that first category, I mean, if I'm out there walking around with my family and I find, you know, something that's interesting, What are you telling me to do? Just leave it there?
Leave it.
Why?
Context. I was trying to come up with an example for this. The way I like to talk about it is, if you go to a thrift store and you find a silver fork, it's really cool, but you don't know anything about it except it's in the thrift store. It's
Providence.
Mingled and mixed with everything else. But if you find that silver fork in a house with its accompanying dishes and china and clothes and furniture, then you know something about the lifestyle of that family. So it's provenience, it's context. If you bring a really cool point to the Center for Big Bend Studies and show it to me and say, isn't this cool? What can you tell me? I can say, well, it's about this big. It's made of this kind of material. Because of its shape, it might be of the same age as this other one that we found that's the same shape, but we found it in context. And, you know, we can tell you the date of that one. And because they look sort of like, maybe it's like that one. But maybe it's not. We don't know.
But there's an ethical feature to this and there's a realistic feature to this. Leaving it there in context, and yet perhaps no one else is going to see it, wouldn't it be better to simply say, look, if people are out there, find something, bring it to us at the center, and if you could find some way to recompense or to have an exhibit and say this was donated by such and such a person, wouldn't this be better than just expecting people to leave it there, which I think is probably unrealistic because most people aren't thinking in the depth of provenance and leaving it in a sort of a pristine state.
What we tell people, and we deal a lot with private landowners around here, private ranch owners, of course, and it's not just open public land, it's their land and it's their artifacts, and they do want to pick them up. And what we try to tell them is, buy a GPS unit. If you're going to pick it up, mark with a GPS unit
Where you found it.
And then bring the information to you.
Bingo.
So there's an educational feature to your program then, that you're going out there to try to persuade people that this is the modus operandi.
Well, what we try to do, yes, we do education. A lot of the archaeological education goes through the Museum of the Big Bend, which is a separate department at Sol Ross. What our education is mostly with the private landowners, because we need to work with them, cooperate with them, get their permission to come on their land to do our archaeology.
So that whole Big Bend National Park, I mean, when you look at the Big Bend on the map, how much of that is private land and how much is national park and state
and
public?
Well, the Big Bend National Park is, of course, national land. The Big Bend Ranch State Park is state land. And I couldn't quote you the numbers, but just looking at the map, that's probably a quarter of the area of the Big Bend.
And, I mean, is there any clear distinction that the closer you get to the river, I would have thought, the more archaeological and historical value there is? I mean, if I'm here 6,000 years ago, I think I'd stick pretty close to the river.
Well, of course, the water patterns were different 6,000 years ago. And some of these little dry creeks now would have had more water in them, or there would have been more springs. Mm-hmm. That's not necessarily true. If you're right on the river and you can divert the water to your fields to irrigate, yeah, that's a different kind of culture. But once you get away from the river, there's plenty of sites. They're just different kind of sites.
This is something that, listening to this conversation, do you have any idea of what the population was? You know, it's saying something
small.
About 8,000 generations.
800 generations.
800 generations, which, I don't know, let's say 5 generations per 100 years or something like that. This may sound a little silly, but you could actually estimate how many arrowheads were made in that period.
It's tempting. It's tempting.
It is.
I will say that we've been doing an intensive survey in Big Bend National Park. And in that area, I've got the numbers here. We've surveyed about 65,000 acres, or will have surveyed 65,000 when we're through. We've located about 1,100 sites. So now those sites can be a few campfires and a few points, so maybe 10 people at a site. Now, of course, we're talking about 10,000 years here, too.
Yeah.
So what the population was at any given time, I would say probably a couple hundred.
Tell our listeners, though, how do you survey 65,000 acres?
You must have
a lot of students involved in this.
Yes, we do. Yes, we do. We have the Big Bend National Park survey team,
right,
which is probably about, it varies, but we've been doing this for 5 years, and it's probably about 10 to 12 people.
You walk every inch. That I know.
We walk about 20 meters apart. We walk so that you can see each other on either side.
Mm-hmm.
You do what they call transects, and you go back and forth, back and forth. So you're looking at an area, you know, 10, 12, 15 feet on either side of you.
And how long does it take to do 1 acre with a team of, what, 10 people?
Or? It all depends on the terrain, of course.
Yes,
I mean, you know, sometimes you're going up and down and sometimes you're going flat. On a good day, you can maybe do 20 acres.
And you've got a plan, a project, and a little diagram in your office to say the next 20,000 and the next 40,000.
Exactly.
And when will you have completed this tile? This is like painting the bridge over the River Clyde. You know, you finish it, then you start again.
Paint by numbers.
Right.
Paint by numbers.
How long do you anticipate before?
We are on the finishing up end of it. We're going to be finishing up this year.
Oh, really?
During the survey. Mm-hmm.
Okay. And then each student gets involved in this. And if they find an artifact, you have GPS, I'm sure. So now does the student take that artifact and clean it and find out a little bit more about it, or is it passed on to another member of your team?
It all depends on the student's particular interests. Some of them just do surveys. Some come back and do lab work.
Okay.
But yeah, in the field, what they write down everything they see. If they come across a site, they map it, they describe it, they take notes, they photograph it, GPS it, and all that information gets fed back in to our analysis.
So what do you mainly find? You talk about arrowheads and pottery shards. That's the major
deal out here is arrowheads.
Petroglyphs and paintings, as you would
and
find
And rock
it.
Art, yes.
You do find it here.
Yes, great deal of rock art is here. Uh-huh. We have one of the interesting things we're doing at the center is trying to define a style of rock art for this area. You know, you've got the Jornada Magallón in El Paso that's quite famous, and you have the Lower Pecos art to the east of us that's quite famous. And we're reanalyzing some of the rock art that's been recorded earlier, and we're re-recording some of it and recording some new stuff and analyzing it, trying to come up with a definition of what is here.
And the pottery charts, I mean, can you begin to discern a particular style, or is a lot of the style imported from other locations? I mean, how does the pottery work?
There's very little pottery. And what there is usually found in the La Junta area along the river. And a lot of that shows influences from the El Paso area.
What do you see as the most important ongoing project that you're involved with now, apart from the ones you've discussed?
Well, I think that the most important thing that we're doing is pulling pieces together. Because there hasn't been any development around here in terms of like Tucson or Phoenix or Albuquerque, where there's been a lot of growth that's forced the archaeology to have been done. With the exception of the looters, most of the archaeology here has not been analyzed. So what we've been doing in the last 5 years is sort of bringing the Big Bend area up to snuff. I mean, we were 50 or 100 years behind in terms of archaeological knowledge. So what we've been doing the last 5 years is racing around trying to find the pieces that are missing. We've done a lot of surveys, a lot of testing, some excavation. And so what's coming up next is to try to pull that all together and come up with the history of this area that has not really been written yet.
Okay, well, I think that's about it as far as we've got time, Melissa. It's been wonderful talking to you, and it's been very interesting to hear you, because you're clearly part scientist and part historian, and you're articulate about both these areas, and it's been a great pleasure.
Thank you so much. Thanks for making the trip.
We'd like to thank Tom Michael down here at KRTS Public Radio for allowing us to come in here and use the studios. We'd like to thank Norma Martinez back in El Paso, as always, putting this program together, and we'll be back next week. Bye-bye.